Hello and welcome to this March edition of the Cambridge Café Scientifique podcast, sponsored by the Medical Research Council. I'm Meera Senthilingam from The Naked Scientists. Pain is a word and feeling used and experienced by the majority of us on a regular basis. Be it back pain, headache, migraine, injury, we're all well acquainted with the feeling of pain and the relief provided by drugs such as aspirin and ibuprofen. So this month, Professor Peter McNaughton from the University of Cambridge set out to explain just what pain is, the many forms of pain, and how pharmacologists such as himself are trying to understand more about it in order to provide better pain relief in the future.
Pain is actually several things. There's acute pain, which is the drop a brick on the toe sensation, and that's vital to prevent us from being damaged by hot objects or by sharp objects or whatever. But then the day after you've dropped the brick, your toe is swollen and hurts, and that's a separate sort of pain, which is called inflammatory pain. That's caused by release of inflammatory mediators that are produced by the injury that have the effect of enhancing pain. So that's the pain that people complain about, is the inflammatory pain. But then, longer term, there can be chronic inflammatory pain from an arthritic knee or something. But the real medical need is for neuropathic pain. And this is the sort of pain that most people haven't heard about. Terrible pain caused by nerve injury, by herpes zoster, shingles as it's known as, or in diabetes, people get this tingling pain in their feet. And there's a huge medical need, and it's very poorly treated.
So these first two types of pain, the acute and the inflammatory, they're beneficial. They have a purpose almost. So you hurt yourself and you know about it and you hopefully don't do it again.
Absolutely. They're very beneficial. So they may not be very pleasant, but they're vital for preventing us from injuring ourselves. And people sometimes have a rare genetic condition where they don't feel any pain. And those people typically live very short lives. They die from traumatic injuries. They suffer chest infections because they don't cough in response to particles in their airways, etc. So being without pain is not a happy life at all. But that's acute pain, and I suppose you'd say acute inflammatory pain. But chronic inflammatory pain or neuropathic pain, these have got no obvious beneficial effect at all, and people that suffer from them just wish they'd go away so they can live normal lives. So that's where the main medical need is.
So this is really quite negative, and this, I guess, is the main type of pain that you would want to try and stop and target the nerves in some way.
That's right, but distinguishing it from the first two is the trick. You have to switch off the neuropathic pain or the chronic inflammatory pain while not obviously stopping people from burning themselves or whatever.
So how do you set about targeting it?
Well, first of all, we have to know more about it. And one of the problems is that all of the pain medicines in common use derived from folk medicine. So they were just discovered quite opportunistically by old ladies called witches who brewed up things in the fens and gave them to people to treat the ague, which was the name for influenza in the old days, or malaria. The NSAIDs family, which is aspirin, ibuprofen, paracetamol, etc., they're derived from willow bark originally, from folk medicine. And the other main pain medicine is the opiates, and that obviously comes from the opium poppy. So to say that we haven't advanced a lot since, well, at least in principle, since the days of witch doctors and folk medicine, I'm afraid is rather true. So we need some new inventions in pain.
So, I mean, although things like the opiates and so on have been around for a while, is it not enough then to understand how they work to try and manipulate those in a way to target neuropathic pain? Or is it the case that they just can't do this and this is why you need new kind of compounds and pharmaceuticals?
Right. Could we just not derive better opiates? Well, the drug companies have been very good at doing that. They've derived much more potent opiates such as fentanyl and a number of others. Could we just not get better opiates? There are two problems there. One is that opiates don't target neuropathic pain very well. So people with neuropathic pain need doses of opiates which leave them completely zonked, to use a common phrase. But secondly, opiates have obviously got side effects. And any opiate, the dream, of course, was that we could develop an opiate like morphine but which targeted pain but wasn't addictive. But this has turned out to be a dream, because all opiates in the act at the same receptor, in the case of pain, the mu opiate receptor, and therefore all opiates that act on pain will also be addictive. So addiction's a terrible problem, obviously, for the opiate family. So what we need are painkillers, firstly, that work, and secondly, that are not addictive.
So what are your research group doing at the moment, I guess? What are you really trying to home in on to try and help these people with the chronic pain?
Well, we do use quite a lot of isolated pain-sensitive neurons, which are, of course, derived from animals such as mice or rats, which are humanely killed, I hasten to add. I mean, there's no cruelty involved. We try to tease out what's happening in the system of pain by getting down to its elements, to the actual nerve cells which detect the pain. I should emphasize that we deal with pain in the sense of pain suffered because of injury or infection. There are lots of other sorts of pain, the pain of sorrow, the pain of regret, and also there are pains which are caused by strokes and things like that, which are physical injuries in the central nervous system. I think we don't begin to understand those problems.
And what would you say, then, your main findings to date have been in this area in terms of getting down to that kind of core level?
Well, one thing that we did about 15 years ago that worked out quite well is we discovered ion channels, which are proteins in cell membranes, that were activated by heat. And we found that these are the mechanism by which, if you hold your finger in a candle flame, you detect the heat of the candle. But more recently, we made what I think is quite an exciting discovery, but it's quite new. It's only about 6 months ago. We found, again, ion channels, which lie at the basis of neuropathic pain. So, as I mentioned, neuropathic pain, huge medical need, very poorly understood. And I hope, we've got to the bottom of it now.
And so the aim would be to target those?
Yes. When you discover a single protein which seems to lie at the basis of neuropathic pain, the immediate thought is, aha, we can develop something that blocks that protein and neuropathic pain will be cured. Now, whether this is going to work or not, we don't know, but the early signs are hopeful. We've got some evidence that by this new strategy, starting from basic science, from cells in dishes and working up to the whole animal, that we will actually be able to target neuropathic pain.
Peter McNaughton from the University of Cambridge. Now, because pain is so prevalent in the population, there were plenty of questions coming Peter's way from the audience, starting with some curiosity about the cause of a common form of pain, the headache.
Right, and are headaches caused by neuropathic or inflammatory pain? No, headaches are classic inflammatory pain. They're caused by, let's say, an alcoholic insult. If we drink too much of what we're drinking tonight, we'll wake up the next morning with that sort of pounding in our head of the headache. Of course, it can be caused by other things. I'm not saying we're all drunkards here. It can be caused by flu or a cold or whatever, or migraines. Here we're dealing with a classic case of a non-noxious stimulus, which is the actual movement of blood in the veins of your meninges, as it is, the casing around the outside of the brain. A non-noxious stimulus which feels painful. So headaches are caused by inflammation in the vessels, the blood vessels of the meninges. And that inflammation is detected by pain-sensitive nerve fibers which innervate those vessels. So the normal, non-noxious pulsing of the blood, because those nerve fibers become hypersensitive as a result of inflammation, inflammatory mediators, they respond to the normal pulsing of the blood by signaling pain, and so therefore boom, boom, boom. Now, one important inflammatory mediator which causes that is prostaglandin E2. And everybody will know, you wake up in the morning, you've got this throbbing in the head, you stagger blindly to the medicine cabinet, grasp some aspirin or ibuprofen, and it really works. I mean, it really works. You know, 20 minutes later, the headache has largely subsided.
And what happens in the cases Peter mentioned where, from birth, someone can't feel pain at all?
What is missing in people that have what we call congenital insensitivity to pain? So these are the very rare people that feel no pain whatsoever. Yes, we do know what was wrong with that boy. He had a deficiency in a particular receptor for a growth factor, which is called nerve growth factor. A growth factor which does what it says on the tin, it causes nerves to grow. Now, it particularly causes those pain-sensitive nerves to grow out. So in the case of this boy, he had a defect not in nerve growth factor, but in the receptor for nerve growth factor. So his outgrowing nerves thought there was no nerve growth factor there because the receptor was defective, even though there was. And therefore, his pain-sensitive nerves failed to develop correctly.
One audience member was keen to know whether, instead of drugs, we could simply remove or cut the nerves causing a specific pain sensation.
How effective is severing the nerve in causing pain relief? The answer is not very. So you would think that when I was talking about neuropathic pain, so somebody, in the case of my cousin, for instance, who has this neuropathic pain in her leg, you'd think, well, you just cut off the nerve and the neuropathic pain will be gone. Typically what happens is that the sensation is gone, but the neuropathic pain is not. So just severing the nerve is not effective. This is a poorly understood phenomenon, but there seems to be a kind of memory of the pain at the level of the spinal cord. So denervation, actually severing the nerve, is not effective in general. It does not remove the pain. That being said, there are a class of people who have a particularly excruciating sort of pain, which is called complex regional pain syndrome. And this is often post-surgery or post-traumatic injury. And what happens is they have swelling and intolerable pain in their arms, if it's the arm which is affected. And then as the months and years pass, the limb becomes blue and useless, and they don't actually recognize it as being part of their body at all, and they find it an encumbrance, even though it still has sensation, and they want to get rid of it. And amazingly, surgeons actually agree to remove those arms, which still work, the fingers still move, they're not dead, but the patients don't recognize them as being part of their body. And typically, the pain is not relieved by this. But nonetheless, the patients report that they are happy with this operation. So they've got rid of something that they no longer recognize as being part of their body, even though it still responds to their commands.
And how about simply distracting someone enough to get them to stop thinking about the pain?
So the question was whether distraction from the pain could be important at minimizing pain sensation. I think the answer is undoubtedly true, that this is true. One aspect that I've rather glossed over, but I think it is very important, is the extent to which pain is a subjective experience, and one could talk about what's happening up here as opposed to what's happening out here. And there have been a lot of very well-controlled experiments in which people are told that the injection tube is put in their arm and they see the syringe going in, and they're told they're receiving opiates, while in fact they're just receiving saline solution. And this has a wonderful analgesic effect. So distinguishing the placebo effect from the real analgesia is pretty complicated and pretty difficult, actually. And a lot of pain is what happens up here, certainly.
And what about external forms of pain relief, such as rubbing a wound better, and more technologically, the use of electrodes to stimulate an area of pain, such as with TENS machines?
Right, so the question was how TENS machines work and how they reduce pain. Yes, TENS stands for transepithelial neural stimulation. So they're machines which give a low-level electrical pulse which would be typically applied to the painful area, which are intended to give some sort of relief. Now, the idea that they might work actually really originated with some work that one of the great fathers of the field, Patrick Wall, did about 30 or 40 years ago. And it originated even longer ago with the sort of folk knowledge that every mother knows with a child that mummy will kiss it better. So when a child bumps their head, you know, it's really true. You rub it and it does get better. So this led to the proposal by Patrick Wall of a very influential theory called the gate theory. And the idea is that stimulation of these are non-painful fibers that are stimulated like this. Stimulation of these fibers somehow gates off pain from getting in. So there's a sort of can close the gate. Now, I've talked about another sort of closing of the gate, which is the endogenous opiates or indeed the exogenous opiates. I mean, that certainly works. So there is a gate. There's something which stops pain getting through. And the idea is that stimulation of what are actually large fibers, myelinated nerve fibers, which are stimulated by light touch, that those would gate off pain as well. Well, it works. We all know it works. The question is whether TENS machines actually works. They're quite widely sold. Their effectiveness has not been shown in controlled trials. It's very difficult, of course, to do a controlled trials because patients know when they're being electrically stimulated, but it's very difficult to show that they actually have any effect. So I think really people have to eventually find something that works for them. Whenever people ask me sort of, what shall I do about my pain? I always encourage them to take a very sort of proactive attitude towards it and try different things. Find what works for you.
And the queries rounded up with a look back at pharmaceuticals to see where the future of pain relief in the form of drugs is heading.
Well, we have a very imperfect series of drugs at the moment. I suppose because I'm a pharmacologist, I'm a little bit biased towards the idea that the future lies in getting better drugs. But I could well be wrong, and for sure we do not have good drugs at the moment. So the leading drug in the field called gabapentin, these help a lot of people, and this drug helped my cousin with her neuropathic pain. But they do come with a price, which is, there's a friend of mine who suffered from Guillain-Barré syndrome and has intolerable neuropathic pain in his extremities as a result of that. And he told me that gabapentin really works. He really gets analgesia from it. But he finds that it also has a sedative effect. So if he wants to function as a normal human being and chat to his friends at dinner parties, he's got to be off gabapentin. So his choice is to have a month of gabapentin in which he's pain-free but like a zombie, and a month in which he has pain but is able to sort of indulge in repartee at dinner parties. So he's a bit caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. And our new drug, which we hope will make it forward to new treatments, this doesn't cause the sedative effect, whereas gabapentin does. We did this on mice. And it's a striking effect. We put these mice on a little rotary thing that they had to hang on to. And on gabapentin, they were just zonked. They fell off. On our drug, they had less pain, but they didn't. So there is hope. There is hope.
Peter McNaughton from the University of Cambridge. Now, many members of the audience seem to have a personal reason for coming along to the talk, so I caught up with some of them afterwards to hear their thoughts on the discussion.
I thought it was quite interesting. I suffer from repetitive strain injury, which seems to be a kind of neuropathic pain, so I was quite interested to see if I get any insights on that.
I've suffered from pain myself for many years, and so it's always interesting to find out what the current thoughts are.
And would you say you learned anything new then about the area of pain or anything that took your attention?
Yes, yeah, I did. It reinforced the different types of pain, and we learned about a new drug treatment that's being trialled in humans at the moment, which looks really interesting, exciting. And I mean, I had a skin accident 20 odd years ago, and the pain relief then was really not very good. And I had a relapse 6 years ago, and the pain relief was completely different. It was worlds apart. So I personally have seen how it's improved over the years, and it's good to see that they're continuing to work to improve even further.
So a lot learned about a widely experienced field of science. Now that's it for this month's podcast, but I'll be back in a month with highlights from the next Café Scientifique, where we'll be putting our thinking caps on to discover how intelligence happens, with Professor John Duncan. The event will be taking place on Tuesday the 8th of May at 7:30 p.m. at Barouche Bar in Cambridge. So do come along if you'd like to experience the event in person. Otherwise, join me for the next podcast. Details can all be found online at cambridgecafescientifique.com. The Triple Helix Cambridge Café Scientifique is sponsored by the Medical Research Council, and the website is brought to you by rabbitholedesign.co.uk. This podcast was produced by me, Meera Senthilingam, from The Naked Scientists.